On va maintenant passer à la première présentation. And I now invite TISED Director Subhasis Ghoshal to introduce our first speaker for tonight.
Merci, bonsoir. It is my privilege to introduce our first speaker of the evening, Dr. Mete Bondal. Dr. Bondal is a professor in the Department of Business and Management at the NHH Norwegian School of Economics. She was a former vice rector and is presently member of the NHH board. Her main research is on energy economics, in particular electricity markets and regulation. She has managed several projects about congestion management in the Nordic power market and on the incentive regulation and benchmarking that governs the Norwegian electricity network companies. Professor Bjørndal currently sits on the Petroleum Price Board and on the board of the Financial Supervisory Authority of Norway. So with that, I welcome you to the floor.
Okay, thanks for the invitation to this symposium. Looking forward to it. I've been working on electricity markets for almost, or maybe even more than 20 years. It's a really fascinating area. I've heard you don't really have an electricity market in Quebec, but I can recommend that. I don't know how many of you are taking photos of power lines when you're on holidays. I do, and I'm not even an engineer. This is the outline of my talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Norwegian economy, just to make some comparisons to Canada. That was a question I was assigned to do as well, just as an introduction. But most of the talk is going to be about the deregulation of the power market and how the Nordic power market is functioning in relation to the European power market as well. If I have time, I'm going to say a little bit about the regulation model and then some conclusions in the end. So we are, as you are, quite fortunate. We are on top of the GDP per capita list, as also Canada is. We are a small population, 5 million people on a relatively big piece of land, not like yours, but still, it's not very densely populated. We have a lot of energy resources. We, like you see on top list here, we produce a lot of energy. We consume quite a lot of energy, but only a small fraction of what we are producing, like 10%. And we are using electricity for based on hydro for the electricity market. And what we export is mostly petroleum products, oil and gas. We are not hit by the resource curse like also Canada. We are very fortunate. The resources that we have given us a lot of wealth. So this is from a report made by McKinsey on sort of evaluating what would be best practices in managing resources in order to prosper and to be in the top right-hand corner of this graph. But this is not something that is coming sort of, it's not just luck. It's also about managing your resources well. So this report is identifying a lot of sort of critical success factors, how to actually prosper when you have this resource base to rely on. So you have three areas to get right, to develop it, to capture value, and also to transform the value into long-term development. And it's interesting to see that on top of the list is Canada and Norway for all the six categories. So not just luck, also good management. When it comes to the last part here, spending of the windfall, I think this may be something you've heard about. This is the, showing the development of the government pension fund global. The name is indicating what we are expecting to use the money for eventually, pensions. I just heard a story about the starting point of this fund. This is Arne Skauge. He used to be a minister of finance in the late 1980s. The bureaucrats were very occupied with a coming banking crisis. But he called and asked for a proposition about establishment of this fund to transfer resource wealth into financial wealth in order to smooth government spending of windfall rents and to save for future generations. He got his proposition, but the top bureaucrat and later central banker who was used to manage the fund thought that there would never be any money in this. He couldn't be more mistaken, to put it that way. So it has been increasing steadily. Even during the financial crisis in 8 and 9, it was increasing. So this is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful way of smoothing out the revenues that you get from these large resources. So this is invested in bonds and real estate and equities, most in equities. And it's spread all over the world, not in Norway. So it's the global part, it's invested abroad. This was the number when I had to leave my slides more than a week ago. It's now increased even a little bit more. So it's like 7,000 billion Norwegian kroner. If you divide that on our 5 million population, it amounts to about 200,000 Canadian dollars per person. So that's quite nice. So how is the petroleum sector influencing the economy? Well, to a very large extent. And this is kind of, well, you know, macroeconomists, their business is being worried. They are worried if the price go up. They're worried if the price go down. They worry about anything. And you see the part of gross domestic product that is connected to the oil and gas sector is what's left when you have the mainland sector distinguished out almost. So it's like a quarter to 40% of the gross domestic product. It varies a lot from year to year. This is from 2014. It's even an even larger part of the export, but not so important for the employment. So a lot of economic analysis is connected to the mainland sector because it's such a big variation in the petroleum sector, so you don't really want that to influence all the numbers that you are producing. And you have to have like this mainland sector operating efficiently. However, even if you have this 75% or 76% of the mainland sector, also that is very much influenced by the oil and gas sector. So this measure here on the left-hand side, focus on that, is very much used in order to evaluate also kind of the indirect effects. So this is about the demand from the petroleum sector to the mainland sector. And as you see, the numbers are recently up to between 12 and 14%. So it's also a lot of impulses from the petroleum sector to the mainland sector. And I say mainland because our petroleum is out in the sea. Also, we have had a decline in the oil price, quite substantial. We've also had depletion of resources. So this is going to change. So I just skipped this, I think. So this is what the ministers of finance and others are showing for the moment when they are sort of picturing the Norwegian economy and also one of the worries for the macroeconomists. So we see that this demand from the oil and gas sector is going to decrease quite a lot, or that's the expectation at least. So that's also the basis of the need for restructuring. So that's sort of one of the main things when you're talking about the Norwegian economy for the time being, is that we need a restructuring. And also, climate change adds to this, but it also gives a lot of new opportunities. So I'm going to turn from sort of the general economic economics of the Norwegian society and over to one of the other resource-based parts of our country, which is the electricity market. So we've always relied on resources. It started already by using the wind for the sail ships. Then we had the hydropower used in the industrial sector for producing or for melting metals and things like that. And then the oil sector didn't come until the 70s and even not maybe before the 80s for real. So this is just an overview of the Nordic market as it is right now, and it shows the different prices in different areas. Also, how the Nordic market has extended. It started as a cooperation between many independent hydropower producers in Norway. We had like 200 independent producers, so that's a little bit different from your case, I think. So they needed to exchange water resources. So already from the 70s, there were, it was like a market organization, or not a market organization, but an industry organization called the Samkjøringen in Norwegian. And that was a place where hydropower producers could exchange water resources. And that is actually the basis for the Nordic power market. First, it became a Norwegian power market from 1990, and that has extended first to Sweden, then to Denmark, Finland, and eventually also to the Baltic areas. So it's one of the first deregulated electricity markets in the world. Energy is traded on the exchange, Nord Pool Spot. And Nord Pool Spot is also quite recently part of the European market coupling. So there's, you could say it's always been a European electricity market. Somehow they have been influencing each other because there are connections between them. But since 2014, there is actually a joint algorithm where you calculate the prices simultaneously for a large part of Europe. There is a vigorous financial market, used to be a part of Nord Pool previously, but it's now organized in Nasdaq OMX commodities. I think recent numbers, electricity is traded like between 4 and 5 times, so it's a lot of liquidity also in the financial markets. One core or an integral part of the logic of the deregulation of the power market was the vertical separation of transmission, distribution on one hand, and generation on the other hand. And that's usually done by separation of accounts, except for Statkraft, which used to be a big generator, and also the transmission system owner and system operator. That was actually divided into two companies. So Statnett is now the system operator, whereas Statkraft is the largest hydropower generator. So you could say we have on the one side, you have competitive supply and demand that meets in a market. And then between to do the transportation, you have regulated transmission and distribution. But even here, we have tried to introduce competition. In 1993, you had a rate of return regulation. First job was actually to establish the book values, which is quite interesting. And then from 1997, there's been an incentive regulation in place. And then you're actually competing against the other companies in the industry. So your revenues are going to be based on how good you are performing compared to the rest. So it's a kind of a yardstick competition. So there is a Nordic market. We have, if you look at the Nordic area in total, there's like 50% plus hydropower. One quarter is nuclear. Then there is some fossil fuels, some wind, and some biomass. But this is very unevenly distributed. So you have Norway, almost exclusively hydro. You have Denmark with thermal and quite a lot of wind. So perhaps the highest wind penetration in the world, at least if you're not counting Texas as a separate country, or parts of Texas as a separate country. You have Finland, which has thermal, hydro, and quite a lot of nuclear. And Sweden is hydro and nuclear, and a lot of biomass also. So also another interesting thing is, of course, in your setting, that we have some big companies, but they are not like dominating. And that's, of course, a very good starting point. This is a little maybe difficult to understand, but this is just to illustrate how this vertical separation is functioning. You have like this energy part, which is on the upper part of the slide, and you have the transport on the lower part. And generation can be connected at all levels, mostly at the transmission level, but can also be on regional transmission or distribution. So you have a lot of companies, network companies in this part, and you only have one transmission company. When it comes to the trading, well, the generators are mostly trading through Nord Pool Spot. So that covers more than 80% of the Nordic power. You have their system price calculated and some area prices calculated. And this number, more than 80%, has been increasing quite a lot during the last 10, 15 years. Previously, you had a lot of long-term contracts with energy-intensive industry in particular. When the deregulation came along, that the volume has been reduced and the duration of the contracts has been reduced, and also it's usually based on market prices. There is an arrow, you see, going back from energy-intensive industry to Nord Pool Spot. They are also trading in Nord Pool Spot. That means that this is a very good source for demand response. So they also participate by having elasticities in their bids. And that's a very good thing. And since we are so much based on hydropower, there are some periods where you have shortages of water, so we are restricted by the energy. Then you need to do this rebalancing of seasons. And when you have an energy-intensive industry using like 30% of the total generation, that's a very good thing to have. And we saw that during 2009 and 2010, there was a dry year, and eventually the industry people, they understood that, okay, we need to buy into this market, we need to bid into this market now, because we can make a lot of money on really skyrocketing prices. And there is no energy, or there is no cap in reality. There is like a technical cap on the bids in the pool, but it's not really a price cap in this market. So the prices are allowed to increase a lot. So like I think the maximum price is like 3,000, 3,500 euros per megawatt hour, which is quite substantial. Okay, and one interesting thing also is that in order to educate consumers, we've actually had two different you pay to two different parties. You pay for the transport one place, and then you pay for the energy another place. So you have kind of two different connection points with who is providing the services to you. But this is going to change. But I think for the time period that we have seen, it's been a very nice thing, because you can sort of distinguish what is what. So it's easier to see when you get your bill from your retailer. Okay, I think this is quite expensive, so I go to the competition authority and I check on the web page if I can have a better deal there, and then I can make the switch. About 15% of consumers are switching energy provider. It's not very high, but it's more than zero, so it also disciplines competition. So I've already said quite a lot about the Elspot. So when we are talking in the Nordic market about the power market, we usually mean the Elspot market. And that's not really a spot market. Well, not in the American sense of it, at least. It's a day-ahead market. So that means that you It's supplemented by an intraday market called ALBAS, and also by regulation or balancing markets. It's a voluntary pool, but more and more people are trading through it, and it's also not voluntary for those who are trading between areas. Then you need to give bids to the pool. The pricing is energy only, but there are different kinds of bids, so these block bids are meant to deal with non-convexities like startup costs and things like that. So when you give a block bid, you say that, well, I can produce at a given price, but I want to produce in like 8 consecutive hours. If not, I'm not willing to do it. So this is the timeline. You have a market for planned energy, which is, well, it's the contracts, it's the L-spot. And then you have sort of the adaptations that you can do until real-time delivery takes place. And when you come to real-time delivery, if something is not going as planned, well, then you have to engage in the regulating power market. And I think this is a setup that is very much, well, it's the result of having a lot of hydro. So what you need to do is actually balancing between longer time periods, because it's you have the instantaneous capacity is really big. So it's kind of the energy, usually, that is constraining your system. But now we see more intermittency, and I think that, well, when wind power has been increasing, we've seen that this ALBAS market has increased in volume. So you need to be able to make adjustments closer to real time. And also there is a lot of interest, not only in the Nordic market, but also in the European market, on sort of having more efficiency into these even shorter term markets, the regulation markets. So I think that's where we will see a lot of changes in the time coming. These are just some numbers from, I think it was from last year. No, it was 2013. So you see here the volumes. It's a large fraction of the total volumes, a lot of members of the pool, a lot of people being active in bidding into the market. And the turnover has increased over time, both for the ELSPOT and for this intraday ALBAS market. So this is one example. What happens is that you set the capacities, the transfer capacities, between the areas. You calculate the prices and you get some flows. And what you see here is really, this is not nodal pricing. Far from it. It's really far from it. But it is an approximation. It's a simplified locational pricing model. And the real challenge is really to set these transfer limits. So, you know, all of these interfaces here are representing potentially a lot of individual links. And for those of you who know anything about electricity flows, it's kind of complicated. So it's difficult to determine these transfer limits. This is a picture of Europe from like 2007. And the red arrows, they are showing how the markets are being integrated. So a lot of things happened between 2007 and 2010. So it's kind of, it's called implicit auction. And implicit auction is sort of the efficient way of dealing with power. Then you decide the prices and the flows between the areas simultaneously. So that's more efficient than sort of auctioning the rights for transferring between the areas. Finally, we have got this price coupling. I won't go through this, but you have different ways of coupling markets. And Europe has been moving towards price coupling. And what that means is actually that there is this central algorithm for Europe. They are collecting bids from all the agents. And they are computing prices simultaneously for a very large part of Europe. So this is the PCR, the price coupling of regions. And they have an algorithm called Euphemia. And in principle, all the areas, all the countries in green here is included in this algorithm. So this is truly a European market now, even in the sense that you are calculating prices in a joint algorithm. I think there's a lot of people who are not really aware of it. It's a lot of controversy because in Norway we have relatively low prices, and to connect to the continental Europe, where prices traditionally has been higher, it's not uncontroversial because it's going at least not to decrease the price in the Norwegian area. And, that's good for the producers, but not so good for consumers and large industrial consumers, for instance. So if we're looking at the European development, we've had a successful integration of the day-ahead markets. It's been operating for more than a year. But there are challenges setting these transfer capacities, and that's really the network flow model. We have the 2020-20 targets for Europe for 2020. We've had a mechanism for carbon pricing. What we saw there was that it seemingly worked quite well. There was a price established for the CO2. It was around 30 euros in 2006 for one permit. But then it suddenly collapsed, and that was because you had too many allowances given to, or there were too many permits around, plus the financial crisis, and the prices really collapsed. Now it's around, it's below 10 euros per permit, and that's not strong enough incentives for this to bite very, very hard. So in addition, you've had subsidies to renewables. And I think most economists would agree that the carbon pricing is the right direction to go into, but it hasn't really come true so far. So instead, we've seen a lot of subsidies to renewables. We've seen massive investments in, like, Germany that has, it's almost destroyed the prices for electricity in the German market. I think since 2008, it's been a 60% reduction in the electricity price in the wholesale market. Problem is that these subsidies has to be paid by somebody, and that's the consumers. So it's very costly to consumers, even if the market price for electricity in Germany is very low. We also seen a lot of mothballing, large write-downs in conventional generation. Remember an example from Belgium, almost 15 billion euros in write-downs in 2013. That's the whole thermal capacity of Belgium. It's also approved by the auditor, so it's certainly deemed not valuable anymore. Even if it's very valuable to the electricity system, you need to have these kind of resources together with the solar and wind. So what are the remedies? I've already mentioned more efficient balancing market. Another option is the capacity market. And they are very much national initiatives. So maybe it's going to change the whole idea of this or the whole practicalities of this internal market, because they are not really well aligned. And national initiatives, so a lot of different ways of dealing with it. So in Norway, we are also interested in this more efficient balancing markets. It's a lot of talk about the green battery of Europe, using our big hydro resources and large reservoirs in order to balance the wind and solar in Germany and other places in Europe. And I guess maybe that's also an idea for your country, for your part of the world. You don't have a lot of wind and solar, I think, on the east coast of the U.S., so far, but it's not that far away. I don't know if that's something you discuss, but that's a lot of attention towards that in the Nordic markets, at least. What we need to do then? Well, you need to build capacity. And what we see when it comes to capacity on the generation side, we see a lot of variation still. Finland is building nuclear power. They have some problems getting it in operation. It was supposed to be in place in 2009. It's still not finished. They also had a clever way of cooperating with industry through long-term contracts on market-based conditions. In Denmark, we've seen a lot of wind power that has been the result of feed-in tariffs and later feed-in premium. In Sweden, they instituted a green certificates mechanism in 2003, and what we've seen there is a lot of fuel substitution. And I don't know, I guess you have a lot of these biomass things in Canada as well. Those Canadians, or I know a couple of Canadians doing research, and at least two of them are in forestry. So I guess that's also one of the possibilities that you have. And in Sweden, it's been very successful. So they've got rid of almost all the conventional thermal generation by fuel substitution to biomass. Eventually, we also had a joint green certificates market with Sweden from January 2012. And there is an ambition of having 26.4 terawatt hours in place until 2020. I think that goal is going to be reached easily. Most of it's going to be in Sweden, even if we're going to pay for half of it. That's also quite debated. So, this is a mechanism that is supposed to be neutral, so then we just have to live with that. When it comes to the cables, what you see here on the left-hand side is the difference in the price variation between Germany and Norway. And the cables are supposed to sort of exploit the price differences. So when the power is, when there's a lot of wind power in Germany, well, we want to import it to Norway. And when there is a lack of it, we can sell it back. So this, if you have these big variation in prices, you can build these sea cables, and that can be a very good idea. So it's a lot of sea cables about to being built, one for Germany and at least one for UK. And it's a lot of discussion about increasing the capacity. And that would be an important thing to have in order for us to become this green battery. So what about network regulation? Well, we have an incentive-based mechanism, and I think I'm just going to skip this. I just want to say that, well, it's based on total cost, including both the operating and capital expenses. And the idea of having an incentive regulation is to trying to introduce some competition-like mechanism into the also the regulated parts. So what the basic idea about an incentive regulation is that your revenues should not depend on your own cost. The revenues should depend on the marginal producer in this industry, given the output, which is volume and quality. While the operating income then would be depending also on how efficient you are running your company. But you also have to think about the fact that you need a sufficient revenue level in order to attract both financial and human capital. And then you also need to think about how to do it in order to have enough revenue over time. You have really long asset lifetimes, so you need to think about that. The needed investments are really big, 600 billion euros, Eurelectric, claim in a report from 2014 by 2020, which is a lot of money. 75% of it is going to be in the distribution networks. And the reasons for it is distributed generation, renewal of the existing facilities, and also smart grids and smart metering. So you really need a good regulation model in order to achieve this. And this is, for Norway, 100 billion Norwegian kroner until 2020. The book value today is 60 to 65. A lot of problems about public acceptance. It's okay to build a bridge, but not to build power lines. I think I'm going to skip this because I don't have time for it. The point is that, this is a lot of detail. When you're constructing a model like this, there's a lot of detail you need to take into account. I just wanted to illustrate that we had a model with a lot of delays. And some of the effects you can see here, you're losing almost a percentage point compared to this calculated rate of return, the calculated interest rate. It's really important to think through how you're actually making these mechanisms in order for them to work. Of course, it would be nice to have like this oracle who could say that this is sort of the optimal way to develop your system. But you don't. And then you have to have a kind of imperfect system. And maybe it's better to overcompensate these kind of crucial infrastructures than better than the opposite. So just to illustrate, it's a lot of different issues around in Norway. It's really difficult to take this into account in a benchmarking model, but that's what you need to do. I think we have managed fairly well. Eurelectric said that, or evaluated our system to be best practice. Some issues still, but it's relatively good. So I think I just skip to the conclusions, or maybe just to have a short view on this. There are some other issues as well, including the electricity market. Well, we have some things dealing with energy efficiency. Turns out that it's a nice thing to have your energy-intensive industry coming home again. Lower prices, new ways of dealing with CO2 emissions, and so on. Also, electrification of the oil production is our way of dealing with reductions in greenhouse gases. And finally, Norway has become the second largest market in absolute terms for Teslas. And that's because of tax subsidies. So this is just a short overview of some related issues, which is not really part of the electricity market, but which is part of the greenhouse gas emission reductions. So just to conclude, I think we could say that both the regulated and the deregulated parts work reasonably well. I would say that incentives work. Just look at the Teslas. But they have to be right in order to be optimal, so there is a challenge there. If you want to correct for market failures, it's a difficult thing to do correctly. I'll also say that general mechanisms are good to promote the most cost-effective solutions, so we see that the generation development is different according to what kind of resources you have. And also, I would like to just remind you that the devil is really in the detail. And there's a lot of details in this electricity industry. So you really have to pay attention to the devil, to the details as well. Okay, thank you.